Eric.
Hey, Charles.
How are you, man?
I'm good.
So we're in C++ world, huh?
We're in C++ world, yes.
Right on. So who's your, who do we have today?
Well, who do we have here? Do we have Stefan? I think the Channel 9 viewers know him very well.
Absolutely, he's a hero.
Exactly. And so, but today we want to learn a little bit more about, you know, his, you know, the human side of him instead of the, you know, the STL side of him. Of course, we'll talk a little bit about C++ and STL as well, but... So let's, like, you know, I'm sitting here next to this kind of your futuristic helmet. So what's the story behind the helmet?
I ride a Segway to work. I've done that every day since 2004.
Wow.
When I first started at Microsoft. But back in 2006, I managed to smash my face into the pavement as I was leaving my apartment complex. They were repainting it, pouring new asphalt over the parking lot to make it look all fresh. And they had opened it up to traffic without painting the speed bump yellow again. And so I was avoiding some stuff, a car going on my right side. Like, oh, I'm going to go up the left side, and that's where the speed bump was. So wham, 12 and a half miles an hour, smashed my face on the left side. It was really bad. Since then, I've worn the helmet.
Okay, well, it's not as bad as what was the guy, the owner of Segway that...
The British guy.
Yes, yes.
Who bought the company and then managed to fall off his estate. Yeah. Riding a Segway XT.
Yes. Yeah. So, anyway, so now, and before you fell off your Segway, how did you get into computer science?
That's actually interesting because whenever I was in, you know, elementary, middle school, even high school, I thought, you know, I want to be a scientist, you know, when I grow up. You know, some sort of vague, nebulous or science thing, like, you know, physics, maybe chemistry, maybe, you know, pure mathematics. Then I got into college, and I'm like, you know, I'm okay at this physics stuff, but I'm not, like, really good. And at the same time, when I graduated high school, I'd always been, you know, messing around with, like, you know, QBASIC, little things like that, BASIC on my, you know, TI calculator, doing interesting things. But I never had, like, a real programming language. And when I graduated, this was back in 2000, I said, you know, I'm going to try to learn a real programming language, and I started with C. Because my friends knew C, I managed to borrow a copy of KNR2, the C programming language, second edition by Kernahan and Ritchie, very famous. A tiny little book.
Exactly.
And the stuff in it looked like, you know, just complete, like, you know, line noise, because it's very different than BASIC. You got plus plus I, braces everywhere, no go-tos, very strange. But it was like, you know, this is what, you know, real people use, and... I was running into limitations with BASIC. I wanted to do things like bit twiddling that BASIC is totally not suited for. So I started trying to teach myself C, and it was very difficult because I never learned it directly from someone, like in a class or something. It was entirely through KNR, messing around with my own programs. Of course, they were full of bugs at first. But I managed to write an SHA-1 hasher entirely from basically KNR2, a few other books, and the spec itself. Which is available freely from the government. And I'm like, yes, I can now hash files, which is pretty cool. I knew that I was, you know, just redoing, you know, SHA-1 sum and other existing programs, but it was neat for the first time to be able to write something that, you know, twiddle bits, implement the algorithm correctly, tiny little program. Of course, it didn't do anything like memory allocation. So this took me, like, you know, a year because I was in college and I was writing this on the weekends and over the summer. Then I started trying to write a program to do PNG compression, image compression. And of course, there you have to allocate memory for the image and for the rows and while you compress. And so I tried to do this in C as well. My belief at the time, and I was influenced by some famous Unix guys, was that, oh, you know, C++ is too complicated. It's full of, you know, horrible features that, you know, aren't really useful to anybody, and they're just serve as a distraction from the pure crystalline goodness of C. And I was very much influenced by that. So... here I am trying to use a straight C to write a pin compression program. It never worked. Crashed all the time. I was obviously doing something wrong in my malloc and freeze. And many C programmers, they have, you know, systems for dealing with memory management and creating higher-level abstractions. Like, oh, you know, if something fails, then go to error. And they have certain techniques for, you know, making sure that the buffers are always the right size. But since I was teaching myself from scratch, I never figured out, you know, any of that stuff. So it was at this point, this was like end of 2001, beginning of 2002, they said, you know, my program is not working, this kind of sucks, I'm used to, you know, everything working the way I expect it. maybe I'll try this C++ thing. At the same time, I had been, you know, taking courses in college. At this point, I was saying, you know, I'm not really that awesome in physics. Maybe I'll try computer science. So I had learned, amusingly enough, Java after C, but before C++ in one semester of college. And I hated the language. I could just not understand what it was doing. The machine model was completely opaque to me. To this day, I don't know what this means in Java. I kept trying to use it, and it didn't do what I thought it would do. Now, I was probably confused, but it didn't make sense to me at first. And that was completely different from C, where I knew everything it was doing. It was just too low level for me to get anything really useful done in it. And then I also used Scheme, which sort of influences how I write programs to this day. But it was definitely nothing like C, and couldn't be used for what I considered sort of real work. I was never that interested in that sort of theoretical side of programming. I wanted to write actual programs that did sort of useful stuff.
But now, to kind of interrupt you here for a bit, because I sense a little bit of a contradiction here. So you say, you know, Java is kind of, you know, you don't understand how it works.
Yeah,
and
it was
but
doing
then
too
you
much
say,
for
but, and then you're saying Scheme, you know, you like Scheme. So
Scheme was
isn't
just
Scheme
very sort of different.
Isn't that even more abstract than C?
It's extremely abstract. It's different. It's not trying to hide complexity. It's saying we're going to just create an austere world of sort of pure mathematics. Whereas Java, it's starting with a C machine model, but then it's layering all sorts of stuff on top of it to try to hide it. You know, no pointers, that sort of thing. Whereas Scheme, you don't even have the concept of a pointer or of mutation. And after doing 4 years of Scheme, this was 1 year of actually learning it, to then 3 years trying to teach it to incoming freshmen, and doing so with some difficulty, I gained an appreciation for how it expresses problems in a functional manner, especially at, like, manipulating functions as first-class objects. That was okay for me. I wasn't super interested by that. What really caught me were the fact that when you write programs without expressing modification of persistent state, they can be very clean, because you don't have to worry, oh, did I modify the variable, and then I loop, and am I seeing the old value, that sort of thing. The flow control is sort of easier to understand. And the other thing was being able to manipulate containers, but in Scheme it's always lists, without looping. My favorite thing, this is something most Scheme programmers don't do, is using apply, append, and map to throw function objects at whole lists in a single operation without any recursion. You could say, I want to apply this functor to every element of a list and then transform it into something else. Or I want to glue together every element of a list by applying a functor to all of it at once. And manipulating lists like that just in one shot was very clean. And I was like, this is interesting. But then the language just sort of breaks down as far as I'm concerned. Whenever you try to introduce modification in Scheme that's done by set bang, it's so scary that they have to put an exclamation mark in the thing. And the Scheme machine model is extremely strange. I sort of understood it when I was teaching it to freshmen. Now it's completely evaporated. They got this thing with environments, and you have to draw environment diagrams to figure out what variables lambdas can see. It's opaque. Nobody understands it. Maybe the professor did, but I really didn't, and none of the students did. So Scheme was definitely not suitable for the programming I wanted to do, and C was too low level. So at this point I said, you know, I've been hesitant to try the C++ thing, but let's try it. How bad could it be? And I'm certainly, you know, I'm sort of giving up on C. And so I tried using C++, and almost from day one, I went into the language knowing that I had to write it in a different way, that my old C ways were no longer applicable. I have to write things according to the new C++ scheme. And the one of the things I did when learning C was I tried to write very portable code that conformed to the standard. The standard was still too hard for me to read, but I knew that I wanted to write code that, you know, that would be acceptable to KNR, and not just whatever crazy extensions or whatever happened to work on x86, that sort of thing. So I went into the same philosophy with C++, and almost from day one it made sense to me. I'm like, oh, it's the exact same machine model as C, except I have like classes, and I can encapsulate things better. I actually understand what the this pointer is. And so it made sense to me immediately in a way that Java did not. And from there, I never looked back. Basically stopped using C. I started learning all the various things of C++, and I managed to do that quickly enough to get hired by Microsoft straight out of college after just like 2.5 years of writing C++ programs, you know, on the side, shirking real work in college, that sort of thing.
but I find it kind of, you know, fascinating, you know, what the way you kind of, you know, I think you're thinking, so you're saying, you know, you want to know what the disc pointer means. Is that, do you mean by that that you want to know how the V-table looks, or, you
no,
know?
Even when I was first starting SIPS+, I abstracted away from the actual implementation. I wasn't very clear on how any of that V-table stuff worked until I started working for Microsoft and actually eventually maintaining the standard library itself. Of course, it helped that. I didn't really use inheritance in any big way. For me, it was always templates early on. But when I first started out, even if you ignore like V-tables, if you ignore inheritance entirely, this pointer is just a pointer to the object that you live in. It's a pointer like any other. It just so happens that you can always access it by being inside a method rather than having it handed to you. And indeed, the way it's really implemented in a compiler or like in the original CFront source translator is that every member function just has a secret this pointer being passed in as its, you know, first argument, which is how you would try to write object-oriented code in C anyways. And that made a lot of sense to me. It's not doing anything really secret behind the scenes. It's just saying, oh, you know, for convenience, we're just always going to give you access to the address of the class you're in. Whereas whatever Java does with the keyword this, I didn't understand what it was doing. But so maybe it does the same thing, and I was just really confused.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, roughly it's kind of the same thing, but maybe it's because, the, you know, yeah. I find it interesting that you pick your language by kind of the ability to understand the machine model.
Yeah, for me, I really don't like, I sort of think of a layer of abstraction or hierarchy. You know, at the very bottom, you know, there's the processor. At the very top, there's, you know, what I want to express. And for me, existing at some level of the hierarchy, what I want is for all the layers underneath me to either, I need to know what they're doing, or if I don't know what they're doing, I need them to work absolutely correctly all of the time. Like, I have no idea how transistors work. Yeah, it's electromagnetic something something. I let the guys at Intel and AMD worry about that. I expect processors to just work all the time. Now, I do need to understand things like caching effects, which I have some, you know, view into. I've never worked that deeply into performance, so I couldn't tell you everything about cache lines. But I know that they exist, and that if I really cared about performance, I would have to go look them up or talk to somebody who knows more about them. But mostly I can just treat it as a layer of magic that I don't need to think too deeply about. Whereas if I look at like the language I'm using itself, I actually do want to know what the language is doing, what the library is doing, what costs I'm paying. As I started to do more and more C++, I tried to write a game program to do like 2D graphics. And this was a point where, again, I got too far away from what was happening beneath me, and I didn't understand what was happening. And this was a very simple, you know, just draw some tiles on the screen, but I was getting terrible frame rates. Like, you know, 10, 20 frames a second for something that should have been pretty simple. And I didn't understand what it was doing or why it was consuming so much memory. It wasn't until much later that I went back, this was OpenGL, and I looked at my old code, tried to clean it up, and I realized, oh, for every single frame, I was blasting this bitmap, a decompressed ping, over to the video card. And at the time I was using AGP, this was using most of my video card bandwidth. It explained why everything was so slow, because the textures weren't just sitting on the video card. I was sending them from the CPU every time. And because I didn't realize that at first the costs were hidden from me, and I didn't realize that something as simple as, oh, if I just write this sequence of calls, it really means, oh, go blast something over HEP. And that's a cost I don't want to pay all the time. I want to do that once, load the texture onto the video card, and then keep it there. And having that happen, when you're not talking to the video card, just, you know, in everyday programming, that's unacceptable to me. I want to know everything that's happening underneath me if it can't work properly all the time. And at least for C++, that gives me a good compromise.
So that's kind of funny, because the way I look at programming is exactly maybe the dual. So I kind of, for me, because for me, I have like this ideal Platonic view of mathematics. Mm-hmm. So, and then the programming language is kind of, you know, a concrete instance of that. So I look kind of, you know, instead of looking down at the machine, I look up.
The programming language is sort of trying to express something in the pure layer.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So there's something pure that I cannot grasp. So I have something concrete, a concrete realization of that pure thing. So it's kind of interesting that you go, you know, the other direction.
Yeah. C++, if you look at it from the top-down perspective, it's sort of terrible for that. because it's certainly not an elegant language. The C++ programmers will be the first to tell you that it is sort of the most non-theoretical language out there. It started as C with classes, and then stuff got added to it over time to make it better and more useful, and that's what's continuing to happen with C++11. As programmers realize a need for something, they try to think, okay, how do I integrate into the language? And there is a level of conceptual design that goes into it. There are certainly things that fit with C++ and have been added to the language, like R-value references, and things that have not, are rather difficult to fit in, like garbage collection. It still hasn't made it into the language. Some people really want to add it. I think they can take their time.
Okay, so let's talk about that one, and then I have a few other questions about, like, the ability to read the program and then, predict what it does. But, like, with garbage collection, so one of the things that I struggle with whenever I use languages without garbage collection is I'm creating an object, I'm passing it to you. How do I know, who needs to free that object?
When does it go away?
Does it go away? And how can I trust that, that you will free it? Or, how can you know that I'm not freeing it, behind behind your back? And those things, now I get into a paralysis, it's like I just cannot think anymore. And so my brain...
And if you get it wrong, the program just crashes for no reason, which is awesome.
So those are things that, those are details that my time, I don't want to waste my time thinking about that, because the computer can do a better job in general. Mm-hmm. So
my perspective on this is, I often like to rant that Ericus Raymond, the Unix guy, I read a lot, wasted a year and a half of my life by ranting that, C is awesome and C++ sucks. And I would not recommend starting with C for someone trying to learn C++ from scratch. It's 2011, C is dead, let's not deal with it anymore. But starting from C as I did and struggling with it for so long did give me a sort of finer appreciation of the machine model, the twiddling, and resource management. So it's certainly the case that in C, where there are really, it's glorified assembly, it's portable assembler, there are no mechanisms for automatic resource management. If you malloc up something, you got to free it exactly once, can free it after you've incremented the pointer or something, and you certainly can't double free it. That would be very bad. Or if you get a resource from the system, like an fopen, you've got to fclose that file. Otherwise, you've just leaked a file. And you better not fclose it twice, that sort of thing. Now, if you look at garbage collection, which I know enough about to not want it, it handles memory pretty well. The thing about memory is that if you allocate memory and you don't release it immediately to the system when you're done with it, in general, nobody will notice. It's okay to keep it around for a little longer. This is how garbage collection works, and it works okay-ish. The problem is that it breaks down under a couple conditions. First, if your resource is not memory, there are plenty of non-memory resources. My usual examples are files, sockets, locks, textures, HWINs, anything you get from the system that you have to give back, and typically that there's a finite quantity of. If I open a file, there's only so many files I can keep open at a time. Or if I have a texture on a video card, there's only so much video RAM. Or if I have a font open, that's consuming some handle somewhere, regardless of, what system I'm using. So with non-memory resources, it's typically more important that I give it back to the system as soon as I'm done with it and not a moment later. Garbage collection makes no attempt to deal with that. It just doesn't fit. So instead you see these solutions grafted on. I really only know the names of them, like finalizers, which is apparently a crawling abomination. Or other languages will have, like, using blocks, where you say, okay, for this block I'm going to use something, and when you hit the end of it, let's get rid of it. So that is sort of leading to C++'s mechanism for dealing with this, which is destructors. If you look at destructors, as far as I can tell, it's certainly in all of the major programming languages that are used in industry, C++ is the only language to actually get this right. What destructors are, they're a universal mechanism. If you have a destructor for a class, it says, when this class is destroyed, typically at the end of its block, it's going to release all of the things it owns, that it has a claimed ownership on, whether it be memory or a file, socket, lock, texture, or whatever. And when the destructor is invoked, the class handles all of that. So somebody outside the class invoking that destructor doesn't need to care what the class has. Maybe the class started out purely owning memory, but at some point later, for whatever reasons, perhaps to support internal guarantees, they had to open up a file, do some caching, write something, or logging, write to the disk, and then close the file. That can be added to the class, and as long as people were destroying it in the first place, which they should have been, as long as the destructor starts releasing that newly acquired resource, people outside the class don't need to know. Whereas if you work in the garbage collection world, then if a class starts owning non-memory resources, that's a big deal. Now you've got to make sure that the class is going to be released, destroyed, finalized, whatever, earlier than just letting the GC get around it. So that's a big problem.
Okay, so now what you're saying is that, you know, that the instance get destructed when, you know, it reaches the end of the block, but now you're kind of...
But not all objects end their lifetimes at the
end
of the block.
And so now you're kind of confusing lexical scoping with kind of, you know,
Most of the time, lifetime is a lexical construct. You've got nested blocks. When you declare an object, it's destroyed at the end of the block. C++ loves the stack. You put things on the stack, and the compiler can keep track of when the thing has to be destroyed without any extra overhead. This is wonderful, because if you have an object, say a vector, on the stack, the compiler can see where that closed brace is. And then it just needs to emit code to destroy that vector. It's not ref counting anything. It's not marking and sweeping. It's not doing anything. Because it can see statically where the lifetime ends. But not everything is a local variable in a block. You've got data members, but those are easy because data members are destroyed when the object itself is destroyed. The hardest one to deal with is dynamically allocated memory. What if you have an object whose lifetime needs to exist beyond that of a single block? And C++ did not really have a good answer for this. I'm going to ignore AutoPointer, which is an abomination and thankfully deprecated, until it got shared putter from Boost in like 2001-ish. So I've been using it my whole programming career, but it is a more recent thing to establish C++ programmers. And now it's officially in C++ 11, yay. With shared putter, it says, okay, we're going to have a deterministic reference counted solution where if you have a shared putter to an object, then when all of the shared putters to that object die, then the object itself will be destroyed. And although this frees the object from lexical scoping, it's still deterministic. So when all those shared pointers are destroyed, the object is guaranteed to be destroyed immediately when it's done. And those shared putters could be local variables, or they could be data members of a class, or they could be members of a vector. It's all recursive. And as long as you can ensure just by the structure of your program that certain bad things don't happen, like allocating something through a raw pointer and never handing it to an object with a destructor that's going to get rid of it, or creating a cycle of shared putter, which is bad, then you are guaranteed statically that your program is immune to resource leaks. And this is something that C programmers certainly can't say, because they're dealing with resource leaks all the time. And in garbage collected languages, A, you have the non-memory resource problem, and B, the garbage collector is not perfect. It can't release things immediately when they're done.
Okay, so now I'm going to push back a little bit, because yes, it's deterministic, but that still doesn't mean that you can, you know, that it cannot be, you know, that you cannot kind of keep holding on to many, many resources, you know. Still deterministic, but maybe, you know, somebody's still holding on to it.
Well, if they're holding on to it, that means they need it. Now, there are ways to say, I would like to observe this thing, but I don't want to keep it alive, and that's what weak pointer is for. If you have a weak pointer to an object, you can be notified through .expired when the object has been destroyed, which is something raw pointers can't do, but you don't have a strong ref on it, so you're not keeping it alive. It is possible, aside from creating cycles, to have leaks even in a fully shared putter vector world. That's like if you have a global object or a long-lived object that's serving as a cache, it's storing shared putters to objects that are keeping them alive, but you'll notice that problem also exists in garbage collected languages. Mm-hmm. And if anything, it's a bigger problem in there because everything is a equivalent of a shared putter in a garbage collected language, and all it takes is one sitting around holding something, keeping something alive, for it to be effectively leaked. Whereas in C++, because it's being very specific and explicit about what you're doing, you're not going to get this ref counting behavior unless you literally type shared putter in your code, which is more verbose. C++ is not the most terse language. But it allows you to be very clear about, okay, this thing is automatic. Oh, no, this thing has a dynamic lifetime, that sort of thing. So it doesn't completely free you from the burden of worrying about, okay, you know, what's keeping what alive, but allows you to analyze it in a more static manner, just looking at the structure of your program, like, oh, what long-lived objects or global objects do I have that have cache-like behavior, rather than looking at the details of every malloc and free, new and delete, or trying to hammer a garbage collective program into something resembling efficiency. The other big thing about garbage collection is that the way I look at it, it was mostly designed for, say, 2000-ish era, late 90s, I mean, we're talking Java here, era where we can just assume processors are just going to get faster and faster, memory is going to get bigger and bigger, we're on the desktop. And we don't really have to worry about either memory consumption or performance. If you look at papers that analyze GC, you can either get one or the other. You can either get decent performance out of a GC at the cost of increased memory consumption, sometimes significant, 2x or more. Or you can get memory consumption approximating that of C or C++, but at the cost of decreased performance. And that was an okay trade-off to have, because, you know, if you've got a desktop, you know, 2000 or whatever, it's not multi-core or anything. You're probably only doing one thing at a time. And you've got, you know, 2 gigs of RAM or whatever. You can afford to spend a little RAM. Now, look at today, where you've got, you know, 6, 8 cores on the desktop. You're doing lots of things at once. If even just ordinary people, you're browsing on the web, they've got, you know, 6 tabs open. Each of those tabs has plugins doing things, rendering stuff. That's a lot of pressure on the system. Processors have really hit a single-core speed limit. They're only increasing a little, not exponentially over time. So we do have to worry about performance of a single core. And at the same time, the desktop isn't the only place. If you look at mobile, those devices are smaller, not only in processor, but especially in RAM. And if you look at garbage collection, it's really not as appropriate on those devices. There are literally reviews of, I guess I can say, Android devices that where you scroll or something and it starts hiccuping because it's garbage collecting in the background. That's not cool. You don't want to expose the user to that. So native code is things like C++ where you can be explicit about what's happening and you don't have a garbage collector running around. It is more work to write, but it allows you to be very clear about where your costs are, and that's important when the costs matter, like on either very large systems like desktops or on smaller systems like mobile.
Okay, so now let's go back to kind of, you know, because I don't necessarily disagree with what you're saying, but I think maybe C++ makes it too easy to make it really hard to look at your code and predict what the performance of your code is, because, you know, you can overload everything. You know, if I see X equals Y, you know, I don't even know, you know. You're saying that, you know, you like C++ because you understand the machine model.
Yeah.
But if you can now overload all the operators, then,
was a big thing. It was very controversial. Yes. Especially in Java, which just ripped it out entirely.
Yes. But what do you think about it? Because, you know, now you cannot understand the program in isolation because you have to now really understand.
Well, you need to know what, you know, classes are involved, of course. And, of course, operator overloading can be abused. But when it's used correctly, which... Really, operator overloading abuse has not been a big deal for, like, the last 10 years, let's say. It increases the expressiveness of your code, making it easier to read, and it doesn't really hide anything from you. Take StudVector. StudVector is my favorite class. It overloads operator equal. What does the operator equal do? Well, it actually does behave like an operator equal for an int. When in doubt, do as the ints do is sort of the best advice. If I have a vector with contents of stuff, and I assign it with equal to another vector, that just copies all the elements. So the value of the vector, which is its size and all the elements within, has been copied over to the destination. Now, that is an expensive order n operation with a memory allocation, but you asked for it. You said v1 equals v2. So if you're familiar with, you know, vector, and you should be because you're looking at code using it or you're writing code using it, then the op equal is just a terser way to say dot assign and then give it the vector, or worse, address of vector if you want to pass things by pointer, while retaining a syntax that's natural and familiar to things with ints. I mean, nobody could really claim that operator equals cost for vector is surprising or that its behavior is surprising. What vector doesn't have is really crazy overloading, like, say, ++ to push back a default constructed element. That would be horrible. So instead you have to say push back t paren paren. Or --- to pop back. It could actually overload that. You could say --- v, but that would be too cute. It doesn't behave like a decrement. So it does not overload --. Whereas if you look at vector iterators, they do. And I absolutely love the STL. Of course, because I started from C, there was a period in like 2002-ish where I was like, I don't know what this standard template library thing is, and it's complicated. So I'm going to go write my own. So I tried to do that, and eventually I came to the STL, which was wonderful, and I've used it more and more. I haven't looked back since. If you look at how iterators work, they use operator overloading like nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
What they do is they use operator overloading to imitate pointers. Every C and C++ programmer knows what a pointer is. You can increment it, you can dereference it, you can say arrow. What iterators do is that they use the exact same syntax. So putting programmers in a very familiar world, so I can say I not equal J or I not equal N, and have it have the same semantics as a pointer, but they conceal, they are concealing stuff. But this is a feature, not a bug. What they're concealing is the fact that they're not simply a raw pointer that's looking at a contiguous memory block. Instead, if you take, say, a list iterator, it has plus-plus, but that plus-plus does not simply increment a pointer, an index, really, into memory. Instead, it's taking a node and following a next link. So it's saying P equals P arrow next, which everybody who's written a single link list by hand has written. So it's doing something different on the machine layer. And I mentioned that I hate it when code tries to conceal that from me. But I've already said std list, so I know I'm dealing with a doubly linked list. If I've got an iterator, then yeah, I know the list is doubly linked. I just want to get to the next element. With an array, a contiguous block of memory, I would just have to say plus plus p. So with a list iterator, I can simply say plus plus I, and that gets me to the next element. And yet, when I see that code, as long as I see std list, I know what it's really generating. So it's okay for that to be concealed from me, as long as I know what it's really doing behind the scenes. I know the cost of doing p equals p arrow next, that because it doesn't have complete locality, it is more expensive than a straight up pointer increment, but it's still pretty fast in the scheme of things. It's not dynamically allocating memory or it's not doing ref counting, anything like that. So I know its cost. I can still use the same sort of loops that I do with a built-in array. And that means that I can treat containers in a more generic manner. And this is where sort of C++ starts to meet that sort of abstract mathematical world. And that's really because if you look at Alexander Stepanov, who designed the STL, he comes from a mathematical background. If anything, the STL is sort of the most mathematically austere thing in all of C++, whereas other things like IOStreams are much more grubby and come from the real world.
But this is the kind of thing that, you know, again, I find it quite amazing, you know, that, like, if you see your code, like, you know, written using templates,
mm-hmm.
Now are you saying that in order to understand that you're thinking through how the templates are expanded and you know what kind
absolutely.
Of...
Oh, absolutely. That's what I like to say. I like to say that I can compile C++ code in my head. If I look at a template and then I look at instantiation or overload resolution or even inheritance... because I'm familiar with the rules of the language, admittedly to a greater extent than most programmers, I have a very clear idea of what the compiler is going to do, what the language is going to do, and what code is going to be generated. Because ultimately, except for a few things like RTTI and exception handling, anything that you write in C++ is being almost directly translated into something that you could write in C. In practice, C++ compilers do not emit a C intermediate form. They did that in the really old days. Nowadays, they do directly compile to assembler. But conceptually, they're just writing code that you could have written as a C programmer, just more conveniently. And so I can look at code using templates or whatever and follow through the rules that the compiler and the language will use to figure out what's going to happen. Of course, I really only have to exercise that ability when something doesn't work as I expect, or more commonly, when somebody else's code that's not working as they expect, and I have to go figure out what it's doing. But it is useful to be able to look at a template and say, oh, you know, I see a specialization there. Okay, that's going to be used instead of this. Or, oh, overload resolution. Okay, that overload's going to get picked, and I can ignore all the others because they're not even getting called. So it certainly would be nice, and this is something I would love for compilers to be able to do, to be able to step through compilation. One of the things I learned Scheme with Dr. Scheme, which is an interpreter that you can get on Windows. And one of the wonderful things that it does, that maybe in other interpreters, but this is where I first encountered it, is you can step through the evaluation of code and see how it expands. Because with Scheme, everything is all this parenthesis stuff. And as a sub-expression is evaluated, it's just replaced with whatever it evaluates to. I would love for something like that to be in a compiler, where I could say, okay, I've got this template, show me how it's getting instantiated, and then show me how overload resolution works. Because if you look at, say, overload resolution, which everybody has used, it's actually a pretty complicated process. Most programmers can go their whole lives without ever knowing the details because it works like magic. It allows you to express a bunch of functions that do different things, and then the right one is selected based on the types. But if you ever do really need to know how overloads are competing against each other, which is a big deal in the standard library, which I maintain, because it's complicated and overload resolution can be very tricky, and we need to design it exactly right so that users coming to us with the weirdest possible code permitted by the standard, and they love writing weird code, get the results that they expect. Because overload resolution does a sequence of steps, I need to play through, I think of it as a game, thinking, okay, this overload's non-viable, this overload's viable, okay, this one is preferred because it's an exact match, oh, this one looks like an exact match, but it's got a constant there that's less preferred. If the compiler would simply tell me, or even better, be able to step through that stuff, that would be wonderful. Of course, that's a very difficult problem to do, and no compilers actually do that. But that's sort of my sort of wish list. That's what I would use IDEs for if they did that.
Yes,
but instead
because
I just use my hat.
And so, in some sense, I think, you know, if I look at myself, is I kind of refuse to use these kind of features because I cannot debug them, mm-hmm. right?
For me, I do not like using features when I don't understand what they're doing at runtime. And if they misbehave or do something unexpected, I have to go debug through them at runtime. I'm relatively not as good at understanding what a program is doing at runtime. Whereas I'm much more happy with something, even if it's complicated, as long as when it's misused or if it does something unexpected, as long as that happens at compile time. But because then the compiler stops and I can figure out, okay, what exploded? Okay, I'm going to go read through this message.
But like in C++, the template language is Turing complete. So in some
sense,
it is sense,
sort of a mini language.
So in some sense, there's no sort of real difference between runtime and compile time because your compile time is somebody else's runtime.
But the difference is that when I compile, that finishes before I ever ship it to users. So if something weird happens at compile time, then I'm like, okay, I can go fix that before anybody sees it. Or if I ship code that, you know, with templates, if I ship code that for a user it doesn't compile, it's exploded on my user programmer's machine, but it's still stopped before an end user who doesn't know anything about C++ has used it. So in that respect, compiler errors are more friendly than runtime errors, because runtime errors can make it all the way to the end user, and we don't want to trouble them with crashes or anything.
But even if you're shipping the template library, then mm-hmm. when I instantiate a template, now I might get errors too.
I call them stealth build bricks. It's possible that code just doesn't compile,
yes.
but nobody realizes it until they actually instantiate that template.
So is there really an essential difference between compile time and runtime in that respect?
There really is, although you can sort of think of it as compilation is a sort of mini language of templates or overload resolution, whatever, being executed on the dev machine. That's where the sort of metaprogramming comes in.
Yes, exactly.
But there is a difference in that what the end user is exposed to and what the code gen is. Because something that could be very expensive at compile time, as long as it emits code, this is a really big deal with templates, as long as it emits code that resembles what you would write in C, it's completely free. It can be order zero in terms of its cost. The compiler will spend multiple seconds grinding. But the code that it eventually mints is something that you could write in C. And that I think, is a big difference.
Let me try to kind of phrase it again. So you write the template library, which for a developer that uses it is the customer. Right, and then the errors.
Oh, yeah,
will
our customers
happen,
do not like template errors. That's just
exactly, and then he is then the user. If you write a template library, yeah. I'm the developer, and then he is my user. But it's just a phasing in time. But the errors will happen, at one point or the other.
On the user programmer side,
yes.
Yeah. And certainly template errors, they're obnoxious. Everybody knows this. Standard template library errors tend to be quite obnoxious, although not as bad as Boost. Boost is even worse. In terms of template errors, it'll admit 1,000-line errors. Even I don't like looking at Boost template errors.
Is the pain not...
It's a hard problem. I think it's worth it, though.
But is the pain not kind of, painful enough that the C++ users or template users demand, we want to have, debuggers for templates?
It's a common request. It happens from time to time. It's a hard problem to solve. Although you'll see things like pretty printers for template error messages. Some compilers have that. Our compiler tries to put the names of template parameters and then expand them in a nested block, saying, oh, you know, ran it really equals vector iterator int. That helps in reading the error. It is somewhat hard because templates tend to explode in the inner guts of an instantiated template. Whereas if you want to trace through what's exactly happening, you've got an outer template instantiating A, B, C, and then it explodes in D. And the problem could exist anywhere in that hierarchy, mm-hmm. Often where the user went and instantiated it, or if the error is in the code itself, somewhere maybe around layer B. Only when you're really lucky is the problem exactly where it explodes. That's a hard problem. All the people who use templates think it's worth it, and there is work being done to try to make it better. The problem is that the work is extremely advanced and difficult. It's called concepts. Concepts were a feature that were proposed for C++ 11. They went as far as being voted into the working paper. That's a big deal. Getting voted into the working paper of an international standard means that dozens of world experts throughout the world who have been working with the language for 10-plus years have figured out this thing precisely enough to write formal wording for it, and then they were all able to agree and get it in to the working paper in order to be shipped. And it got that far. And what concepts would have done would have been great. It would have sort of moved templates from their current world where they're very sort of delayed. And a template isn't really instantiated and checked for correctness until it's actually used. So if I have like a sort, I simply say sort template on ranit, and then I take ranit first and last, and then I'm going to say things in the guts like first plus 5, last minus n, because I need to do random access in order to a quick sort. So what I am expressing as a programmer is that the arguments, the template parameters, to the sort function need to be random access iterators, like pointers or vector iterators. They can't be like bidirectional iterators, like list iterators. But I can only express that through documentation, either on MSDN or whatever, or through the names of the template parameters. But that's not actually checked by the compiler. The compiler doesn't care if it sees template tightening T or template tightening ranit. So if I actually do try to sort list iterators, or I swear it even happened to me, I had a const vector, and I gave its beginning end a sort, and I stood there mystified for like half a minute. Why am I not sorting my vector? Because this horrible compiler error, wait, it's const, duh. That checking can't actually happen until all of the template is instantiated, all of its guts, and then it tries to write an expression like I plus 5 or dereference I equals something, and then that explodes because the iterator is either bidirectional or const or something like that. The checking is deferred. What concepts would have done is they would have provided a way to say straight up when you write the template itself, okay, here are the requirements for all of the generic parameters to my template. So template tightening ranit, this ranit has to be a random access iterator. I'm going to express that concept in a certain block of code saying, okay, it needs to have expressions like iter plus 5 or iter plus some integer, iter minus some other iter that returns an integer. And if the generic type argument to this conceptized template does not satisfy these concept requirements, then right then and there reject it, saying that, oh, you know, list int iterator does not satisfy the concept of a random access iterator, even before you instantiate the guts. So the error would have always been at compile time, but this is moving it earlier mm-hmm. in compile time, and detecting errors earlier is always better than detecting them later. So concepts would have been great for that. They would have dramatically simplified template error messages to the point where ordinary mortals could understand them without freaking out. The problem was that it was so complicated, and more importantly, no compilers existed for it or could have existed for several years, that they had to specify it all in advance without having real-world experience. And so a controversy arose in the committee that was very technical in nature, and I was not an expert on the concept stuff, so I could sort of only observe it as a third party. But basically, one camp was looking at it, and they were saying, okay, you know, this concept stuff is good and all, but we think it's going to require users to be too verbose, that they're going to have to declare all this stuff as satisfying concepts ahead of time rather than allowing the compiler to deduce what concepts are being satisfied by a type. And that would have been difficult for users to use. It would have not followed the philosophy of templates, where as long as I have something that satisfies some template, I can just plug it in without having to declare ahead of time, oh, I need a derived from base class sortable and base class random access iterator. Templates don't follow that approach, and it's been a great strength of the language. The fear was that concepts would have removed that and would have had required extreme verbosity in order to declare things as, okay, this satisfies this concept, really. And another camp of these experts would say, oh, you know, it's going to be cool. We think we've, you know, sketched it out that, yeah, you'll have to write these concept maps some of the time, but it's not going to be really bad. And even when they're necessary, it's going to be good for users. And it was controversial enough that it was backed out of the working paper. This was a huge multi-month thing where they had to revert to an earlier version of the working paper, ripping out all of that voted in language. That it was massive. It significantly affected almost every aspect of the template wording of the core language, plus others, and it had massive changes throughout the standard library, because every standard library class, like StudVector or StudSharePutter, had to be conceptized. So that got ripped out, and yet all the changes that had been applied independent of concepts had to be reapplied to the working paper, so there was a lot of churn. But the committee just wasn't comfortable enough with saying, okay, we think we can see how users are going to write code, even though the standard libraries for it don't exist, the compilers for it don't exist, and we certainly haven't used it even in a prototype way ourselves. They just didn't have the confidence to say, you know, this is something we're comfortable voting into an international standard and determining the course of the language for the next 10 years and really for forever, because it's so hard to rip something out of the language. So we don't have concepts in C++ 11. They're still being actively investigated. The hope this time is that somebody will write them in a prototype compiler and say, look, here's how we think they should be. Is everybody pretty comfortable with this? And then that will be refined and eventually voted into the next C++ standard, whatever that may be called. Mm-hmm. It really was just too early for them, and although a lot of people, including myself, are really looking forward to them, we're going to have to stick with the current world order for a little longer, where you do get horrible template errors, although there are things that advanced template programmers can do to make their user programmers their lives easier. This is something that Boost has been pioneering, and that I would like to add to later versions of VC as I get the time. You can see all of my to-dos here. I've got multiple pads of graph paper with multiple layers of post-its on it. I have a lot of to-dos. One of the things I'd like to do is we now have the facility in VC10 already shipped called Static Assert. This allows you to trigger a assertion at compile time when something that you can detect at compile time is no good. Like, oh, you know, this code is only for 64-bit. Or, oh, the size of this struct is not equal to the size of this other struct, and yet I'm going to copy between them bitwise, so they really should be identical. One of the things we could do with templates is try to static assert up front as much as possible. Mm-hmm. So if we've got sort, there's nothing in principle stopping us from looking at the iterator category, which we can do manually, and then static assert if that iterator category is not a random access iterator. We can be like, oh, you know, this thing calls itself bidirectional, so I'm not even going to try to instantiate my guts. Instead, I'm going to direct you to a function that's going to static assert, and I'm going to essentially abbreviate that horrible, multi-line, multi-page compiler error down to something more manageable, where the static assertion, the wonderful thing about static assert is you can include a message in English saying, oh, you know, this thing does not satisfy random access iterator. And it would be more verbose, certainly for us, the maintainers of VC, to go add in all the static assertions rather than having it automatically done on concepts. And it wouldn't produce as nice error messages for users as concept would have, but it still would be pretty close. It would be a lot of work, but I think it would be valuable work. And that's something I would like to do more and more going forward. So, because we do recognize that debugging template errors is not really anybody's idea of a good time. It may be my idea of a good time, but I'm kind of weird. and we'd like to reduce that as much as possible. And Boost has sort of done that too, because they suffer from horrible template errors even worse than we do.
But like in a normal program, you debug by kind of putting printf statements or, you know, you put breakpoints.
That's my sort of favorite debugging technique.
Yes. But then when you debug templates, how, you know, you have to use different techniques. So what are your secrets?
Well, what I do is, the first question is the code even compiling? Because if it is, then you can just put a breakpoint on the thing that eventually gets called, and just by looking at the stack trace, you can see, oh, I'm getting the generic implementation of my template, whereas I expected the specialization. Or, oh, I got the specialization being invoked, but it's not the right one. I want this other guy. So if you can figure out where it's ending up, that's good. Or more commonly, you've got code that just doesn't compile at all. In that case, what I do is I started to do a sort of two-step process. Because first, you only ever want to look at the first error that's being embedded by the compiler. When you get very sort of very advanced and very familiar with the code base, then you can learn to recognize error spew. And this applies not just to template errors, but errors in general. And you can recognize which errors are real and which ones are cascaded, where the compiler basically got confused because they're not perfect, especially given broken code. And you can figure out, okay, which ones indicate real problems that I can go fix all at once and then iterate again on a compile, or which ones are likely to be just a consequence of some other error that I can fix. When you don't really know which ones could be cascaded, the easiest thing to do, the thing that I'll save you the most time, is just to look at the first one. Because the first error emitted is the one before the compiler got confused by broken code at all, and it is certainly going to complain about something that is either wrong in the code or wrong in the compiler. So you look at that first error, and the first thing it's going to complain about is the actual site of the explosion. You know, something didn't work because, you know, some function doesn't exist, or you don't have the right access privileges, or you're trying to assign to something that's const, whatever. And you should try to figure out, okay, right then and there, is something wrong with that line? If that line is wrong, then go fix it. If the line in isolation isn't wrong, then there's going to be error context. And this is something that VC and its tools are sometimes not ideal about. If you look at just the error log, it's got this notorious thing where it'll only capture error messages themselves, but then there's also what we call template instantiation context, where it'll say, error C1234, with template arguments x equals vector int iterator, blah, blah, blah. And all of that with template argument stuff is considered additional context. That's not always captured by the error log. Instead, you have to look at the full build log, where all that context is. That's the really important one to look at. You don't want to look at only half the error message, so then you're really confused. So looking at the full error message, if you look at the types involved, you'd be like, okay, is something about these types, well, first, are the types good? Are they what I expect? If they are, then you look at the expression, okay, something wrong with this expression for these types. Or if the types themselves are wrong, then you need to figure out, okay, where are these types coming from? And that's when you go to the next step of the instantiation context, and you're like, okay, who was instantiating the site of the explosion? Like, if I've got a sort helper function, who was calling that helper function with instant sort itself? And then see if anything is wrong with that chunk of code, and then go out and out. The other way to attack it is you're still looking at the first error, but you go to the bottom of the instantiation context. This will often be in one of the source files you control, especially if you're looking at an error where it's exploding in the standard library or boost, and it's being driven by code in your program. It'll say, you know, foobar.cpp, where foobar is your program. It'll point to a line number. So you look at that line in isolation, and you ask yourself, okay, given what I'm giving to it, you know, the types and the values, is this going to do what I expect? Because this will point to a sort call, and if you see, oh, I'm sorting a const vector or a list, I'm like, oh, you know, these types aren't right. I can just basically ignore the rest of the error. And so you sort of work your way in from both of the errors, top down and bottom up, until you can figure out what's going on. It could end up being simple. I've debugged really thousands of errors at this point, not all from my code, usually from people on our internal C++ mailing list or, you know, actual customer code. And errors can happen for lots of reasons. You know, code is just busted. Like, you know, you wrote something wrong for a template that doesn't work for sufficiently generic types, or other ways for it to explode are overload resolution. If you're overloading lots of things, it can easily get, it works most of the time, which is why it's magic. But it's very particular about, oh, exact matches are always preferred over things that aren't quite exact, even if it's minor, like adding consonants. And so if you're setting up a complicated system of overloads, it could easily be the case that, yeah, the code you wanted to get and that would compile is sitting over here, but a slightly different overload was chosen, that one's completely inappropriate and it's going to go explode. Or it could be in, you know, specializations, you didn't write a specialization correctly, you know, that sort of thing. It really could be any sort of error. But as long as you just sort of step through mentally what the compiler is doing, you, the programmer, have a decent idea in your head of what you expect. And wherever it starts to diverge, like, oh, I didn't expect this code to be called, then you can sort of narrow it down and say, okay, why isn't this getting called? Is something wrong with the overload? Is something wrong with the arguments? Am I not including the right stuff? Whatever it could be. So it would be nice if the compiler would tell you. The problem is that even given a really advanced compiler, sometimes your intent is such a high level that the compiler can't see and it's low level because it's only working with classes and overloading it without, you know, things like concepts or static search, it can't realize ahead of time, oh, you've got a list and iterator. This is not going to work eventually. It has to go through the whole process of, oh, you're calling sort, call the helper function, then try to save plus n, and oh, that plus n explodes, but it's like a puppy. The puppy will whine if it's hungry or if it needs to go outside, but it can't tell you what's actually wrong with it. You, the master, have to go look at it and say, oh, you need to be walked or you need to be fed, that sort of thing. So the good news is that there's still room for human programmers. We're not yet to the stage where we're all running in fear for our lives from Skynet. But we can get the compiler to do a lot of work for us. We just have to help it along when it gets confused.
So. And the language needs to evolve, and it will with concepts once Grande and Gang get it together.
Yeah.
Because the other thing about the concepts that I was talking about is they were terribly slow. Like, the performance was horrific.
I had to do a lot of sort of checking and validation.
You got it. And so that, you know, that's an interesting point, because the, in C++, you're supposed to guarantee that you can add high-level abstraction without costing performance. And that's apparently what Bjarne demands and guarantees.
Yeah, it's one of the sort of founding concepts of C++.
Well, speaking of founding concepts, do you think concepts will actually live up to that? We don't know yet.
Well, I think a lot of the concern was compile time in addition to runtime. It's harder for me to see how concepts would impact runtime performance, because after the compiler does all of its checking, it's still going to emit the same code at the end of the day. But in terms of compile time performance, you know, we don't want our translation units taking 10 minutes to compile. That would suck.
Yes.
And so, but concepts do want to do sort of more validation. It's a hard problem. I don't know. That is one of the things that we can simply throw more cores at.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So, and like, since the template mechanism is so powerful, now you, as a programmer, you're faced with a choice. It's like, where do you do your computation? Because you can decide to kind of do stuff at compile time, or you can and make your templates more complicated, or you can push stuff at runtime. So how, when you design a C++ program, how do you decide, you know, where to put that boundary?
I usually don't have a straight up choice between doing computation at compile time or runtime. It's very infrequent that I'm doing some sort of static calculation, like Fibonacci numbers, that I could get a template to do. Instead, it's more the sense of, oh, I want to handle something generically. How should I do this? And my usual rule is, if I don't want to forget types at runtime, then I want templates. Because templates will all compile out, and they are preserving full type information, which is very important. Sometimes I do want to forget type information at runtime. This would be the case where, say, I have a vector, say I'm writing a game. I've got a vector of enemies. My enemies could be boss enemy, or Goomba, or Koopa Trooper, or whatever. And if I've got this vector of enemies, I want to forget parts of their type. I want to forget the fact that they're derived, and instead only look at their base class abilities, like, oh, hit points and execute some action, and yet recover that information at runtime with virtuals and inheritance. And in that case, I actually do want virtuals, that sort of thing, and I don't want templates. But I'll still mix templates in there, because I've got a vector, and the vector is of some arbitrary element type, or if I'm owning these dynamically allocated objects, there I want a shared putter. But the actual genericity of having different actual enemies derived from a common base class, that will be handled by inheritance. Templates wouldn't be appropriate there, because I'm trying to mix in all of these different types under one banner of some generic enemy. So my usual first resort is templates, but I will use inheritance when necessary and mix them together too.
But I was thinking also about, like, things where you can use templates to do unfolding or inlining.
Okay, yeah.
And so now you have to make a choice between, like, you know, like getting a bigger program or, you know.
One of the favorite things I like to do in the standard library, and this is one of the tricks I picked up from Bill Plauger of Dinkumware, is you can write a template that is correct for arbitrary arguments. We're big. Whenever you have a template, you're usually saying something like, I want to handle arbitrary arguments, or the variadic templates, arbitrary numbers of arbitrary arguments. And yet sometimes you can look at a certain type and say, oh, I can do something smarter for this type.
Exactly.
It happens all the time in the standard library, like for std::copy. std::copy takes arbitrary iterators. And if you give me an arbitrary, like, list iterator or something, or a user-defined iterator, I can't do anything better than saying, you know, plus plus I equals plus plus J, and just increment each of them. But if you give me raw pointers, you've given me an int star, and I'm copying to another int star, and I can see the size ahead of time, instead of writing that iterator loop, I can say, oh, I'm just copying bits around. I can call std memmove, and that will expand to a very special sequence of assembly instructions that can be faster than the core language itself is capable of. So instead of writing like a runtime test, you can write essentially a compile time test using metaprogramming to say, oh, I want to detect int stars, or in general, any sort of pointers to scalars or pointers to bitwise copyable objects, and then use overload resolution or a specialization. In our case, we use overload resolution to stick a different function in there that we'll call memmove. So it's a compile time optimization, and it's completely invisible to the user of the template because we're still accepting arbitrary arguments. We're just doing something smarter for types that are known to us. It occurs in lots of places. Being able to bitwise copy stuff is the one that happens most commonly in our code base. But there's lots of opportunity for these sorts of, I can detect a special type and do something special for it in lots of code bases. And it's all powered by templates. It's free because it all compiles out, which is nice.
So how often do you compile your code? Because, you know, like, I'm lazy, right?
Yeah.
I cannot live without IntelliSense. I compile, like, every 2 seconds because, you know, I want the compiler to find, I don't, you know. But probably can you code for, like, a whole day and then kind of compile and it works?
Well, I have a very strange job because I write very little code completely from scratch. Actually, VC11 has the biggest chunk of code I've written from scratch in ages at Microsoft. That's Collection H, which is some of our WinRT stuff. It's like a 40-kilobyte header that I wrote completely from scratch. Most of my work in the standard library is bug fixing or, you know, fixing up small features. And there I'm working in an established code base that's not even Microsoft's, it's Dinkumware's, where I'm just doing small tweaks that, you know, drastically affect other things. But in terms of my actual content, it's like a line here, a line there, you know, a function here. That sort of thing.
But so when I recompile after every change, or do you?
Well,
kind of,
the fun part is that our build system doesn't really handle incremental compiles. It's pretty messed up. It should. So I'm very paranoid. I would rather spend the time doing a full compile if I'm guaranteed that it will work, or if it explodes, it's because it's actual problems in the code, rather than being contaminated from an earlier build or something. Instead of trying to do an incremental build, but it picked up something stale because the build system is completely busted. So, because I'm paranoid, what I do is I'll make changes in the standard library, and then I will completely scorch out everything and do a full build from scratch of the compiler and libraries. That takes me 35 minutes, and it sucks. But it's better than the 2.5 hours it used to take me on my old dev box.
But, you know, C# and VB aren't the only things in the IDE, and Eric knows this because even our dear Eric has been writing C++ recently.
Well, the thing is...
Should I have said that?
Well, sure.
But let me just say this. You get squiggly lines.
Yes. Squiggles are nice. I am tempted by them.
Those are great.
Yes. When I'm writing for Channel 9, I'm like, oh, it's a squiggle. I can just fix it there. Thing in the standard library is that within DevDiv, our build system is powered by MSBuild, and it doesn't directly work with the IDE. I think there's something you can do for some conversion to actually build VS itself for the IDE. But that's like a complicated process, and I haven't gone through and tried that myself. It may not even work right now. Our build currently is powered just by command line. I go in and I type BR, and that's a macro that expands to MSBuild. So there, the IDE really isn't even an option there. Plus, for templates, most of the issues I have aren't with actual the code itself, because I can be pretty sure I don't forget semicolons. That's one of the things working in a plain text editor teaches me, is to be very precise about where I put my semicolons or whatever, rather than the IDE telling me, oh, you know, you should complete this sort of thing. The usual things I have to fix up are, oh, I wrote something that's not quite generic, or one of my favorites right now is writing address of an element when I really need to say std address of, because I got to handle classes like ccomputer that overload the address of operator. That's something that nobody will detect until somebody actually goes and tries to instantiate it with a ccomputer or whatever. So for me, the speed of compilation isn't a huge deal when I'm working on the standard library itself. But the other thing is that I spend, you know, maybe 80% of my time, especially when sort of trying to debug issues, is that because I'm a library developer, I'm never working on a huge application of my own. Last time I did that was an Outlook. Instead, I work on this library where individual chunks of it can be used in user code. And when something's wrong, typically it can be demonstrated with a very small test case.
No.
So most of my time is spent compiling little, like page, two-page long source files on the command line, sometimes with crazy compiler options, often just with, you know, MTO2GL or whatever, and seeing how they explode. at compile time or runtime, whatever, and then sort of tracing through either mentally or with the debugger or with Source Insight what's making them explode, and then going and tweaking the standard library. So for that cycle, I always use my plaintext editor because it's just an individual source file, and then I run it through the command line. And that allows me to not only invoke like VC10SP1, because I've got a shortcut for that, but also the just build compiler itself. Because when I build VCTools, which is the compiler libraries, that build is only the toolset. It's not the IDE.
Sure.
If I wanted to build the IDE, that's, A, quite difficult to do on an individual dev box. Plus, I would have to do a real install of the thing. That means a virtual machine. I do have to do that for like maintaining visualizers, but that's a lot of work. I like to avoid that if all possible. If I'm just running a toolset, I've got a batch script. That just sets my include path, my lib path, and my actual binary path. Then I can use a just built toolset and compare, say, VC10SP1 versus my current build of VC11 and see how they differ. Sometimes it's a regression. Sometimes VC11 is doing something better. And that difference will go clue me into, oh, what are we doing? Like, I just got some report that unordered set is like 1,000 times slower in VC11. And I confirm that by just running...
1,000 times
slower? Oh, yeah. It's like, wow. And it's only for double. That's the weird thing. It's slower for double, but it's not slower for unsigned long-long. For unsigned long-long, it's like 2x slower. And I'm like, okay, I could see how we could get 2x slower, but not 1,000.
Why can you see getting slower just between versions?
We go change a lot of stuff. It could be something as simple as, oh, we added checking where there shouldn't be. I haven't figured out where that 2x is coming from.
Sure.
But that 1,000x is really bad. I'm like, what are we doing? And it could end up being a floating point or something. The thing is, I don't trust floating point. Floating point is weird. It has all these sort of little things. But even then, 1,000x is unprecedented. I never see anything that big. And yet I was able to confirm it just by running it through VC10 and VC11 and just seeing that one or the other disagree. Because I'm paranoid, one of the things I like to do is I like to measure what I'm looking for. Some people will report bugs saying, I see that the debugger is doing blah, 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 or like I'm looking at a local variable and it's got some wrong content. The thing is, the code gen was completely fine. It's just the debugger, because they were looking at optimized code or whatever, wasn't showing them the right value. Because I try to avoid that as much as possible. I look at the final output, either the output of a program, do I get what I expect as a crash, how much time does it take beginning to end for the whole program? And if that's slower, then I know it's observably slower and it's not the debugger lying to me or some other complexity introduced by profiling. So I tend to work very simply when I'm looking at little test cases, and that's most of my work. As a library developer. That and looking through horrible template errors and trying to figure out, okay, what did we do wrong or what did the user do wrong? Sometimes it's that. Something as simple as saying, make pair with explicit template arguments. That explodes now. And explodes for a really subtle reason that people seem to discover every month and I have to go explain, okay, we broke your code, but the standard told us to break your code. So here's why you have to go fix it. So really, that's sort of the life of a library dev.
Wow.
Good.
Well, amazing. Wow, you're. I must say, you are super hardcore. That's kind of it's really amazing.
Yes.
It's a
yes.
Yep.
And the other great thing about STL is he's like a hero on the internal C++ aliases, man.
That's
always answering questions with code.
That's actually how I got hired by VC. So I started. Outlook hired me straight out of college back in 2004. And I was posting on our internal manual as VCSIG, the Visual C++ Special Interest Group, because I had learned, modern C++ before starting at MS. So whenever people had, strange problems with either the core language or often the standard library, I would, explain what was going on with, detailed analysis or whatever. And so the lead of the libraries team at the time, Martin Lovell, had seen all my mails back in 2006. And sent a mail to me one day saying, hey, have you ever thought about, joining VC itself? And I was like, hey, that sounds cool. That's how I got hired by VC, and I started in January 2007. So I've been at this, maintaining the STL thing for almost 5 years now. But I didn't start out that way. And it was a mailing list.
Yeah, wow.
Nice. See what can happen?
Yeah.
you send mails out that upset, like, a whole org that usually that's not going to work in your favor. Right on, man.
Yep. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. It was nice to meet you.
Yeah. And that was really impressive.
Absolutely.
Yep.
Thank you, Stefan.
Thank you, Charles.
That's a lot of time, and we're going to see you again.
Yeah, I got to spin up
Channel 9. Let's spin it up.
Yeah. Plus, I can show off VC11. Like, for the longest time, we couldn't say VC11, talk about what we did there, but we did a massive rewrite of the containers, made them all smaller. I squashed bloat. That was one of my long-standing to-dos.
Perfect.
We had bloaty allocators that we finally smashed out, and the thing is, we can only do that between major versions. We break binary compatibility between every major version of VC, and that gives us the freedom to do things like change container sizes. And we just didn't have time during VC10, because we had all that R-value reference stuff going in, but in VC11, we made the time, in addition to all of our allocator rework.
Cool.
So
we will see you. We will see you soon.
Yeah.